is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast, NBA preview extravaganza. We've teamed up with podcasters from every NBA city to do a deep dive into each team, recapping last season, discussing their key off-season roster moves, the most intriguing storylines, best case, worst case scenarios. Plus, each of our guests weigh in with a prediction for their team's regular season record and how far they'll advance in the playoffs or not next spring.
We think you'll love hearing from these experts around the league about the teams they cover day in and day out. We'll put out 6 episodes broken down by division over the course of 6 days from October 14th through the 19th, leading up to opening night on October 22nd.
Jason and I will weigh in with our own thoughts on the coming season on the final episode of the Hoopheads Pod Preview Extravaganza that will drop on Monday, October 21st. We know you're going to love hearing from this great lineup of podcasters from around the NBA.
This episode covers the NBA's Pacific Division, the Warriors, Clippers, Lakers, Suns, and Kings.
The Golden State Warriors with Adam Lauritsen, former GSW Fast Break blogger for the San Jose Mercury News. All right, want to welcome to the podcast Adam Lauritsen, former Warriors blogger for the San Jose Mercury News. Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be on.
All right, we're going to talk some Golden State Warriors basketball. Let's start out by looking at the Warriors season last year, which didn't quite end up the way everyone thought it was going to way back in September, October of 2018.
Yeah, there's no way to sum up game 6 other than a surprise. The Warriors, I don't think, ever expected to be in that position, given all the hype going into the year, given all the success they had had, and to have 2 injuries in the finals the way that they did, and to have that final game with Klay getting injured and the heroics and everything happening there, you couldn't have scripted it. It was pretty shocking, pretty incredible. But I think that the overall feeling for most Warriors fans at the end of the season was a mix of sadness, but also just pride. It wasn't a series where the team underperformed. They really gave it everything they had. They lost to a very good team. There were long odds given the injuries. So you dust yourself off and come back the next October and start all over again, which is where we are.
I know Jason and I really felt like going into that finals, especially coming off what they did in the last couple games with the Rockets, which was, you know, to be able to adjust and on the fly, we really felt like, man, the Warriors are going to come in and really take care of business against Toronto. And it turned out that the combination of Durant not making it back, and then obviously when he did make it back for that short stretch going out, and then Klay's injury, it just felt like they were kind of climbing up a hill that they just didn't have enough. They just didn't have enough firepower to get there. And I know as Cleveland fans, we could certainly relate to that feeling because we felt that way most of the years, of the 4 finals, even the one we won, we certainly felt like we were always climbing upstream, trying to get there, and just didn't have the same
amount of firepower as the team that we were going against. I think that's, as you described, that's kind of how the Warriors season went last year. So then you get to the offseason and big changes come to pass and Durant leaves. You bring in D'Angelo Russell. And so obviously that's the biggest change. Clay won't be back until, you know, he recovers from his injury at whatever point that's going to be late in the season. So talk a little bit about the departure of Durant, kind of what that means for this coming season, and then maybe what D'Angelo Russell brings to the table that can help propel the Warriors during the time while Clay is still out.
Yeah, I don't need to tell anyone how big of a loss in terms of talent Kevin Durant's departure means for the Warriors. But the one upside to it, if you're going to find any silver lining, is I think it really clears the air for the team. There was a lot of drama hanging over the team. Obviously, the Draymond Green-Durant dispute had been heavily reported. But everybody was just kind of looking over their shoulders. There was a lot of tension last year. So that's gone. There's sort of a feeling now that the stakes are lower. They have a lot of new people in. There's a lot of excitement about trying to integrate those new people. I think Russell is going to be a really fun piece for them to play with, particularly on offense. So there's excitement. There's uncertainty. There's that kind of butterflies in the stomach going into the season that I don't think had been there for this team in the last few years. So that's going to be a net positive ultimately. But then the downside of that is that they just got gutted on the bench. There were so many people who were their rocks, the Andre Iguodalas, the Sean Livingstons, who just aren't there anymore. So apart from Durant being gone, the Warriors are really going to have to grapple with not having those veterans able to step up and stabilize them in the nights that they just don't have it or when somebody's down with an injury. You look at the roster right now, they probably have four proven legitimate NBA players who are healthy on opening day. And you have a whole lot of unknowns, a bunch of journeymen, a bunch of really young guys. So maybe it clicks, maybe it comes together, but there are going to be some rocky games, particularly at the beginning of the season for this team.
Were you surprised of the Draymond Green extension at point when it happened?
I was a little surprised. When he signed with Clutch, I thought that there could be a situation where he was going to try to squeeze them, try to play them off other people. But I think the Durant dynamic actually provided a good opportunity for him. Durant decided to move on. Warriors respected that decision, and Draymond could contrast himself to that. He could rally with Clay, with Steph, come back to what they had built together, and really lock in for the next 2 to 3 years where they still think that they have a championship window if they can get a few more pieces around him.
Is there a guy or two of those, the bench crew that they've signed, that you think could potentially fit really well with the key members of the rosters, or somebody that you think is going to, whether surprise or maybe just fit in really well with sort of the chemistry of what they have going?
I would have said Willie Cauley-Stein until he showed up wearing a boot on his foot to media day yesterday, because I think his athleticism and his awareness around the basket would fit really well with the passers that they have on this team. If you can get up to the rim and get open, Draymond and Steph are going to find you. So I think he would have thrived in that system, and he will when he gets back. But it's always rough when you're coming onto a new team and you don't get training camp to orient yourself. But the other name that I'm looking at is Omari Spellman. He reminds me a little bit of Mo Spates back when the Warriors were on the ascent, 2014-2015, and Spates was a catch-and-shoot player for them, really played in the mid-range, was a stretch five who could give them a lot of offense off the bench. If Spellman can keep his weight under control, if he can play within the Warriors system and focus, I think he has the potential to really have a nice breakout season.
He's a local guy from here in Cleveland, actually. He grew up here. What do you think is the number one storyline that you're going to be watching heading into the season? What's the number one thing that you're interested in seeing how it plays out?
Defense, defense, defense. Everybody at the beginning of the Warriors' run slept on their defense since they had such incredible offensive players, but it really was their calling card when they were at their absolute best. That defense is gone. Draymond Green is still here. But without Clay, there really aren't many other defenders on this roster. Looney's a solid defender. He's a flexible defender. But Draymond and Looney can't do everything. So what the Warriors are going to have to grapple with is you have two gifted offensive guards right now with Curry and Russell. But both of them are going to get exploited on defense. They're going to have some really rough matchups, and there's nowhere to hide them with Clay Thompson injured. And so I'm going to be watching how those guys deal with it and how other teams exploit the Warriors' lack of size and lack of defensive experience to really push them.
What do you expect from Steph this year? What do you expect offensively for him to what do you expect his offensive statistics to look like now that he's going to obviously have to carry a much bigger load than he's had to in the last couple of years for sure?
Two big caveats. If he can stay healthy and stay out of foul trouble, I think it's going to be his best offensive season that we've ever seen. He's going to have the green light. They're going to need him to be a volume scorer. I think Russell will draw enough defensive attention away that he's not going to get mobbed the way he's been in the past sometimes when Clay's been injured. I think that's one of the reasons why they got Russell, in addition to just being an asset, is that they knew that he could help take some of the defensive pressure off Steph. But he's going to have the green light, and they're going to need him to shoot because there are not a ton of other scorers out there on the floor with him. I think we could easily see him up above 30 points per game, and he's going to make a whole lot of threes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I can't remember if I read it or I heard it somewhere in the last day or two, just his per 36 minute stats when KD and Clay were off the floor in the last couple of years. And it was some ridiculous number. Like he averaged like 43 points a game over 36 minutes when those other guys weren't on the floor. So it's going to be a crazy Steph year for sure. All right. What's your best case, worst case scenario for the Warriors this year?
Best case, they win the finals. I think when you have Steph, Draymond, and Clay, you're always going to be in contention. It's really going to come down to the role players and the young guys. Maybe you have two or three role players who really elevate their game. Maybe a couple of the young guys are better than the Warriors expected. Maybe there's some injuries in the West that makes it easier for them to get back to the finals. So that would be the best case. I don't think that's the likely outcome, but it's still on the board. Worst case, I think, is Steph gets injured. Steph really is the key to this team. So if he goes down with something during the season, this is going to be not just a lottery team, but a pretty miserable lottery team until you get Clay back. It's probably going to be after the All-Star break. So there's a huge variance for this team because they're really dependent upon one or two pieces clicking. And there are a lot of unknowns right now on the roster.
All right. So in between that best case and worst case, where do you see them finishing up?
Wherever they hit the Clippers. With Clay back, assuming that he's healthy after the All-Star break, should make the playoffs. And I think they're going to be good enough with Clay back and everyone else healthy to beat pretty much anyone except the Clippers. But I just don't think that they can get past them. So depending upon how the West shakes out in terms of the rankings at the end of the year, they could hit the Clippers in any round. And I think that that is going to be the end of their postseason.
There's a lot of teams in the West. I mean, you start looking up and down that Western Conference, and it's just, I mean, it's like a murderer's row of teams. No matter where you finish, I think, out West this year, you could end up with a very difficult first-round matchup where I think anybody could beat anybody. And, you know, health, as you mentioned with the Warriors and Steph, obviously, I think every team has that one key guy that if that guy goes down, totally and severely impacts what their potential, you know, what their potential finish could be.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a wild ride, particularly with some of the younger teams growing into their own. I think this is the year that the Kings may kind of get over the hump and be a playoff threat. The Mavs have a lot of talent at this point. You know what? You don't know what they're going to do. Utah got a lot stronger. Denver got stronger. The Clippers obviously got stronger. The Lakers got stronger. There's a lot of competition out there. But all of those teams, if the Warriors are healthy, are pretty decent matchups for them. They know how to play them. The Clippers are just the one team that the combination of defense, scoring, physicality under the basket, I just don't know how this team is presently assembled gets past them.
Well, it should be, if nothing else, it should be a different sort of year there in Golden State because you're going in with a lot less expectation. There's going to be, I think, a sense of, as you mentioned, just a sense of freedom and sort of that air of tension has been lifted. What's the vibe for the new arena? What's the feel on the new arena?
It's generally positive. I think that people are excited. It's bright. It's shiny. It's fancy. I think that there is still an undercurrent of the feeling they've priced out a lot of fans. Some of that was happening when they were still in Oakland, just given the increase in ticket prices. But with the PSLs for the new arena, I think that that's really left a lot of people behind. It's also just a modern arena that's divided and really carved up into different clubs and different sections. The beauty of Oracle Arena or the Oakland Coliseum, as we knew it back in the day, it was really open. You could just kind of wander around. Everybody was together. You were jammed in the hallways. It was sort of a dump, but it was kind of a dump shared by everybody. And it was really focused on the basketball. So we've lost some of that, but everything changes. Progress marches on, I guess. And everybody generally seems pretty excited with Chase. It's going to be a really impressive building, I think.
Yeah, I think it'll make for a different feel for sure. Adam, we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us here and talking some Golden State Warriors basketball. Maybe at some point during the season, maybe before a Cavs-Warriors matchup, we can jump on again and just kind of check in and see where the Warriors are during the regular season. So we appreciate you jumping on and being a part of our NBA preview pod, and hopefully we'll catch up with you at some point later on in the season. Thanks.
Great. Thanks.
The Los Angeles Clippers with Charles Mockler from the Locked On Clippers podcast.
We're pleased to welcome to the podcast Charles Mockler from the Locked On Clippers podcast. Charles, welcome. Thanks for jumping on with us to talk some Clippers basketball.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here and talk the new Clips.
Yeah, it's a totally new look season. definitely going to have a little bit of a different spin this year than what the Clippers have been for the last year or two anyway. So talk a little bit about last season and how that wound up, and then we'll go on to the exciting offseason that the Clippers have had.
I mean, last season, if you look at it just in the context of by itself, let alone what happened in the offseason and to get us to this point, it was absolutely incredible on all fronts. I think Vegas had us at 33 wins. That's just disrespectful in its own right. I personally didn't think we were going to pull off 48, but the team came together in a way that was, I don't know, it was just incredible to watch Bev and Lou really galvanize everybody from the get-go, and the emergence of Trez, and, you know, the trade deadline was absolutely insane, and Doc talked about, you know, having to really convince guys that we were still going to be competitive after that because no one kind of knew what was going on. But, it was a whirlwind. That's kind of a boring metaphor, but everything happened so fast in the playoff series. I mean, I don't like to talk about hyperboles and stuff like that, but I feel like that, you know, that playoff series helped show, you know, maybe Kawhi and Paul George what we were actually all about and everything like that. And then, I don't know, it was if they had a plan, I think it exceeded even Lawrence Frank and them, Jerry West and the rest of the front office's expectations for what could have possibly happened last year.
Do you think it was more the chemistry between the players, or do you think it was Doc's leadership, a combination of both? What would you attribute the sort of unlikely success that they had last year to? One of those two things or something else?
It was a combination of everything. The timing of, you know, we drafted Shea, and only because of an Avery Bradley injury did we end up putting him in the starting lineup. Myself and a bunch of other Clippers fans were frustrated with that whole situation. But, you know, that small injury that happened, that got Shea in the starting unit, which allowed us to see what he could become. A lot of us thought he was going to remain on the team. Sadly, you know, business is business. But it was that. It was Doc. I mean, Doc, the season before last, coached his ass off to get us to 42 wins, I think it was, and that was incredible. So I really think it was a large part of it was Doc kind of hitting this second or third peak in his coaching and the franchise coalescing around the message that Ballmer has been instilling since he's been the owner of, we're going to do things our way. We have these players. They understood everyone's role so well. And it was everything. I think everything had to be working perfectly for last season to happen.
Yeah, I think that that's definitely the case, that when something like that kind of coalesces, when it's unexpected and you had breakout performances from guys that maybe hadn't played as well in the past. And as a result, you brought everything together underneath Doc's leadership and Ballmer's ownership, and things just seemed to be trending in the right direction. And then that led you right into an incredible summer for Clippers basketball. So talk about, first of all, the two main guys that went out the door when Kawhi and Paul George came in, losing Shea and Gallo. Just talk a little bit about what those two guys meant to the team, and then obviously the new guys coming in.
That was huge. If you look at, we traded Tobias at the deadline too. So that was three guys who at the beginning of the year, everyone was talking about, okay, so we're going to re-sign Tobias. Hopefully he doesn't want a max. You know, we got Shea. This is going to be great. Gallo, maybe we get another healthy year for him. We can just build on this win. And then by the trade deadline, that was already out the window. And then, I mean, losing Shea, that's any Clippers fan, that is the hardest part of this whole thing, I think, was getting rid of him. He seemed to really enjoy playing here. He had two of the best veterans I think you can ever have, and Bev and Lou Will, you know, teaching him and getting coached by Doc. And Doc was hard on him because he understood what he could be. So losing Shea, I think, is the hardest part. Gallo put so much into last season and had such an incredible season. He stayed healthy. I think he only missed 9 games. It was kind of a redemption year for him. I think he was also opened up to a lot of people who didn't understand kind of his background and his attitude towards the game in and of itself. But losing those guys, I mean, the Thunder gained a couple fans because we're all going to be rooting for Shea. So we hope he does well. We hope Gallo does well. But, you know, it just hurts. But that's the price of landing, two top 5, top 10 players.
They have Chris Paul, too, man. You can cheer for Chris Paul, too.
Yeah. Yeah, we're happy Shea gets to learn under him. So hopefully he gets nice Chris Paul and not ornery Chris Paul.
That's right. What's Shea's ceiling, in your opinion? Where do you think he tops out as an NBA player if he fulfills what he's capable of in your mind?
If he can do what he's capable of, he can be a top 5 point guard at some point. He's a ball hawk, which I think a lot, I watched him play, but he's a ball hawk that people miss, I think. He's got one of the smoothest around the rim packages. It took him some learning last year. He definitely had some rookie moments where early in the season he was just getting obliterated at the rim when he would try and do some kind of cheeky fake. But he got it. He got his finishes on point. He can finish with both hands. He's just got to work on his shooting and defending. But it's incredible what he looks like he can be. And now, like you said, learning from Chris Paul, I'm so excited to watch him grow.
All right, new guys, Paul George, Kawhi. First of all, what's Paul George's health status? What are you guys hearing there? When's he going to be ready to play?
So the Clippers, as every NBA team, is very close to the chest. Lawrence Frank said, we don't talk in timetables. We let our medical staff go over that, which means they're not going to tell us until – I think we're not going to know until, pregame when Paul George is putting that jersey on. But all the promotional stuff, the Clippers are sure as hell – posted a lot of pictures of Paul George playing against coaches and going through drills and stuff on social media. So if that's happening, it doesn't seem like that initial diagnosis of maybe he was going to miss 6 weeks. I don't think it's going to be that long. I don't know if he's going to play opening day. I personally would like him to maybe kind of rest a little bit and hang out. They're talking about how Kawhi is going to play around 70 games this year, which has me a little worried too, but Paul George looks healthier than I thought he was going to look. And based on the Clippers' social media, I think it might be much less than 6 weeks before we see Paul George play for the Clips.
So what does it all look like when you put Paul George and Kawhi into the returning group? In your mind, what does that chemistry look like? What does the fit look like for the Clippers when they put their starting 5 out there and they start competing? Where do you see that group kind of coming together?
Jackie McMullen talked about this. She talked about how Kawhi and Paul George are two great examples of great players who you can kind of put on any team, and they can play within that system with a little, they're a little more flexible than some other big stars in their playing styles or something like that. So that, these two guys' playing style fits so well with the Clippers. We have a bunch of kind of specialized tools that all work together, and these guys are kind of our do-it-alls, which is fantastic. They can take over games, but their play style doesn't mandate too much just succeeding to them. The fit, it's two stars that, it fits perfectly with the team identity. The defense on the first unit is going to be suffocating, which I feel like people aren't talking about as much, which is understandable because the offense is pretty incredible to think too, especially our bench unit. But that defense, when Rex Kalamian gets some of his schemes in there and stuff like that, that's going to be maybe the best part of the team. It's going to be hard as hell to score on this team with Bev at the one and then some combination of Kawhi, Paul George, maybe Mo Harkless at the 4, Jermichael Green at the 4, and Zubac at the 5. That's a tough lineup. I don't know. That's a hard lineup to score on. I don't care.
You probably have two of the best – certainly two of the best 5 perimeter defenders without question, maybe two of the best 2 for all intents and purposes in Paul and Kawhi. And then that says nothing about, as you mentioned, their offensive skills at the other end of the floor.
Yeah, well, and then also, you know, you turn around and there's Patrick Beverley. So it's a, I mean, it's like, I feel like it's like that clip in The Simpsons where Sideshow Bob keeps stepping on all those rakes. That's what I feel like ball handlers are going to feel like a little bit.
People aren't really talking about it. They're sleeping on the Clippers defense and what it could look like if those guys are all healthy and out on the floor at the same time. So what's your best case, worst case scenario for this Clipper season? Let's start with the worst case and then.
Oh, thank you. That's what I wanted to start with. Worst case, realistically, you know, I don't want to get all doomsday on it because it is the Clippers and we've all, you know, it's been pretty bad. But worst case scenario, I think the lack of a true distributing point guard might come up to hurt us in terms of just distribution and figuring things out early on. The center position is a little bit shallow. The franchise really seems to believe in Zubats. But, you know, if you watch the playoffs, there's a little bit of defensive fixes to take place. And then, you know, health. I mentioned that, you know, everything good had to happen last year for us to win 48 games, and health was included in that. So there's always that situation. I'm not going to put any specifics on what I think might happen because I don't want to be that guy who they play the take of who got all the horrific injuries right. But it, you know, that's always a, and that's a worry for every team. But yeah, I think the lack of distributing point guard and maybe a shallow big lineup could be a little tough to overcome.
You think Harrell's going to get more minutes as a result of that?
I don't know. He's kind of a matchup guy. They really pick his spots well. I don't think he's ever going to start because we've all seen how that works. And him and Lou, I mean, it was literally the best pick and roll of all time last year. So I don't think you can break that up.
Right.
And then you also have Shamet out there. I think Trez might see kind of a dip in his numbers. I think he'll still be crazy efficient. But, I mean, that bench unit, when Shamet, if he moves down to the bench, is going to be Shamet, Lou, Trez, maybe Jamichael Green, and then, you know, Magruder or something like that. So there's going to be this weird thing where I think everyone's efficiency goes up, but maybe the numbers go down a tiny bit.
Got it. What's the best case scenario?
Best case scenario is winning a championship. That would be best case. I asked the people on Twitter, the Clippers fans, what their bare minimum for what a good season is. It's like, so their floor for a good season.
Uh-oh, this is a scary question.
Yeah, this is
scary.
Scary Twitter for Twitter. That's scary.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, so Clippers Twitter is pretty chill. I will say that. Clippers Twitter has not yet been bathed in success enough to be rude, which I think helps us out. But they said the floor is the Western Conference Finals. A lot of people were saying that that's their bare minimum for a good season, which I don't know if it's mine. I just think if everyone stays healthy, we have, you know, we have one of the best shots of winning that championship.
So if you had to make a prediction, think about mm-hmm. what you actually feel kind of in between best case, worst case scenario, when next April rolls around and the regular season's over, where do you see them finishing up regular season record wise? And then where do you think they're going to go in the playoffs? If you had to make a prediction, where do you think they're going to end up?
Record-wise, I think we're going to be top four, maybe not the best regular season team. Nuggets are crazy deep. The Jazz are really good. It feels like every team in the West got better. And, you know, some teams are built more for the regular season. I think win-wise, I think we're going to be around 54-ish. Something like that. Maybe not. I don't think more than 60. I think that would be fantastic, but I don't know if they'll put too much of a precedent on that. I think they maybe just want to get one of those home playoff seeds. And then I think in the next 2 years that we win a championship. I think that it feels very weird to say that. But this, you know, this team, and we're going to have kind of some contract situation with Trez. We're going to have to re-sign him after this year, which is kind of a bugaboo, but so far this front office has made everything work. So I have to just trust in them.
Understood. All right. What's going on with the arena and the city of Inglewood? What's the story there? That'll be the last thing. We'll wrap up with that.
Mayor Butts of Inglewood has been pretty cool with the Clippers. He was at the Playbook event, which is the season ticket holder event they hold. Ballmer just donated, you know, $100 million in the whole neighborhood, which is great, which I guess is fine to do. It feels a little bit like
greasing the palms a little bit.
Yeah, but like if you're greasing the palms with wonderful charity, I can't really be that. You know, it's hard to be mad at that.
True.
Everything seems to go. There hasn't been any more kerfluffle from James Dolan and Jeannie Buss, so that seems to have fallen by the wayside. But 2024 looks like it's good to go. I'm going to be honest, though, I have no idea how long it takes to build a stadium. That one they're building in Vegas, they keep saying it's going to be ready for football next season, but I don't know if you've seen the pictures. It does. They're going to have to do a lot of building between now and then. But everything seems like a go. I think it's going to be an absurd arena. It's going to have everything there they need, training facility. It's going to be exciting. Hopefully we'll have a banner to put up in it.
That would be great. Charles, this has been a lot of fun. I think you're going to have a fun season getting a chance to cover the Clippers. And, you know, you went from Lob City to what you thought was going to be kind of a shallow period here of Clippers basketball. And it's amazing how quickly the team resurrected itself and got back. So we want to say thanks to you for jumping on here on the Hoopheads podcast NBA preview with us. We really appreciate it. And hopefully at some point during the season, maybe we can catch up and jump on together again and talk some Clippers basketball.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
You got it. Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks.
As you've listened to the Hoopheads podcast, one common topic that continually comes up in our conversations is character. I'm fortunate to be associated with the Positive Coaching Alliance, a national nonprofit movement that provides valuable tools, training, and resources for coaches, athletes, parents, and administrators that is centered around sports and educational psychology and organizational behavior research. PCA combines this research with practical advice from a national advisory board of top pro and college athletes and coaches who utilize PCA principles at the highest levels of competition. Through a partnership with our local Cleveland chapter of the PCA, we are pleased to offer a discount code to allow you, our listeners, to take a PCA online course for just $20. To take advantage of this offer, visit the store on positivecoach.org and enter the discount code HOOPHEADS20. That's HOOPHEADS20 with two capital H's. Coaches, I hope you'll take advantage of this great offer from the Positive Coaching Alliance and help us continue to grow the game. The Los Angeles Lakers with Alex Hollingsworth from the Lakers Central Podcast.
All right, tonight we are welcoming to the podcast Alex Hollingsworth from the Lakers Central Podcast to talk some Los Angeles Lakers basketball. Alex, welcome.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely excited to get you on and dig into what's going to be a very interesting Lakers season. Let's go back, though, first and talk about last year and just kind of how things transpired. Obviously, LeBron goes down in the middle of the year and, you know, you're working on looking at what the young guys are going to be with the specter of Anthony Davis coming at some point in the future. So just talk a little bit about last season.
Yeah, man. So last season was a letdown. Most Laker fans, myself included, expected LeBron to lead this team to the playoffs. And LeBron has dragged a number of teams to the finals throughout his career.
We can attest to that.
Yeah, I guess you guys could.
We can definitely attest to that.
So we had that expectation, and I didn't have an expectation that he was going to win us a championship last year, but I figured, hey, we'd make the playoffs. And you fast forward to Christmas Day, and we're up on the Golden State Warriors by like 20 points. We're blowing them out, and it looked like, okay, this team might have something. And then LeBron goes down. Lonzo has injuries. Rondo goes down. The team just was never right after that. And we ended up missing the playoffs. So it was a rough year.
So when you look back at that, and, you know, we've obviously had LeBron here in Cleveland for a number of years, and he's been somewhat indestructible in his career. And so it was somewhat surprising from our perspective, at least, to see him go down with the injury. And then I think as it appeared that the season was going south, you know, if the trajectory had been different, I think he probably would have come back and played at the end of the regular season if there was a chance that the team could have made the playoffs. So all that being said, with the disappointment and with the, you know, the Anthony Davis and the all that stuff that went on during the middle of the season, and I think that kind of alienated some of the younger guys like Lonzo and Brandon Ingram. And so now you head into the offseason with the idea that what are we going to do? How are they going to reshape the roster? What's going to happen? And eventually the Anthony Davis trade goes down. So talk about that from your perspective, what your feelings are on it, about the guys that left, about obviously Davis coming in, how you think he's going to fit, and just give us an idea of what you think the roster changes are going to look like for this season.
Yeah. So look, man, last season when Anthony requested his trade from New Orleans and it was, you know, Lakers were one of his preferred destinations. I was all for it. Like, look, man, I'm a big believer in Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, and Josh Hart. But when you have an opportunity to get a 26-year-old superstar just entering his prime, who's going to be a future Hall of Famer, you trade whatever you have to trade to get him, period. The Lakers have never been a team that has developed talent. So when you look back at all the Laker championships, you go back to the championship that Jerry West won, right? Jerry West was drafted by the Lakers, but they ended up trading for Wilt Chamberlain, all right? You look at Magic and Wilt. They drafted Magic, but they traded for Wilt. I'm sorry, they traded for Kareem. You go to Shaq and Kobe. They traded for Kobe's draft rights, but they signed Shaq as a free agent. Then you go to Kobe and Powell. They had Kobe, obviously, but they traded for Powell. Like, the Lakers don't develop talent. They might develop one guy, but they're going to steal your guy. That's what we do. and so when you look at Anthony Davis, you go for it. And I understand he couldn't drag the Pelicans to the playoffs consistently, but he's a hell of a talent, man. And even you look at these first couple preseason games, Anthony Davis and LeBron James, they look as good as advertised as a duo. You know, I've got their plus minus numbers already. And in our first game against the Warriors, you know, obviously it's all preseason. But while LeBron and Anthony Davis were on the court during our first preseason game, we had an offensive rating of 132 and a defensive rating of 83. I mean, that's a positive 48 points. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? And you look at game two, same thing, a positive 14 points. Game three, we were negative one. But all that's to basically say the pairing looks like it can be legit, assuming they remain healthy.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that they fit together really well. The one thing that I think has been a national media story that I kind of look at from our perspective here in Cleveland is, you know, you've heard this idea that LeBron is going to defer to Anthony Davis and he's going to set Anthony Davis up for this MVP run. And with everything that we've seen here in Cleveland with LeBron, I'm not sure that that's what's actually going to happen. That's not to say that LeBron's not going to make Anthony Davis better as a player simply because of the way their skill sets merge. But unless LeBron somehow comes to the realization that his body is breaking down or he just can't play at as high a level as he has before, I just don't think mentally he's wired that way to defer to somebody else. And so I think that that's the one thing and the only thing that worries me about their pairing from a standpoint of them fitting together on the court and having complementary skills. I mean, I think if you look at all the big twos that have come together, you can make a pretty good case that these two fit together better than just about any of those other big twos that have come together throughout the league. So I think it's something that I think it's going to work well. Like I said, I don't think LeBron is necessarily going to try to get Anthony Davis the MVP, but I do think that together they can be very, very good. Let me ask you about the rest of the composition of the roster and what you think of these guys that they brought in and what the lineup looks like right now. Who of these guys do you see, you know, you start coming down the stretch, you know, next March, who are going to be the guys that are still going to be in the rotation that you think are going to fit well with the big two?
I mean, well, the easy answer is Danny Green. He was our big signing outside of bringing Anthony Davis in via trade. So I think Danny Green is most important. Kyle Kuzma is absolutely our third guy. Throughout the preseason, the Lakers' second unit has really lacked a guy that can get his own shot, and that's Kyle Kuzma all day long. As a third option, he's perfect for that. And then for me, if I was to kind of pick a starting lineup, it'd be today. It would be Anthony Avery Bradley, Danny Green, LeBron, Anthony Davis, and JaVale McGee. let's go with that and see what happens. But I'm interested to see how these other guys look. I mean, I want to see, can Avery Bradley get back to what he looked like as a Celtic? I want to see, can Alex Caruso be a legitimate NBA rotation player, potentially a starter? And, you know, those are things I'm interested in. I want to see if Dwight Howard was in Orlando, but can he give you 10 and 10 when he needs to, you know, start a night or play 30 minutes a night? Can he do that? Is he healthy? Those are things that I'm kind of looking at, and I'm interested to see how they play out through the season.
What do you think in terms of Kuzma really filling that third spot? What do you think he needs to do this year to be at his best in that third spot? Like, to me, I think he's got to really knock down open threes at a little bit higher rate maybe than he has in the past. And I think the thought is that because he's playing with LeBron and Anthony Davis, that he's going to get more clean looks at it, and that's going to help his percentage. Where do you stand on Kuzma, his shooting, and just kind of how he fits in at that third spot, as you talked about?
Well, it absolutely comes down to shooting and defense. Now, if Kuzma can get back to what he did his rookie season, when he shot 36% from 3-point land, he's good to go. Now, he shot 30% last year, but rookie season 36%, and I would assume with all the open shots he's going to get with LeBron and Anthony Davis, he has a good shot to get back up to that rookie season 3-point average. If he can do that, if he can knock down the open three consistently, and then when he's on the floor by himself without LeBron and Anthony Davis, if he can kind of be the guy against second and third units, and then he can play competent defense. He doesn't need to be all defensive or anything like that, but just be solid. And I mean, there's no reason why he can't be that third guy for this team.
Yeah, he definitely has the skills. I think if you look at what his production's been, you know, it dropped off, the shooting since, as you said, since his rookie year. And I think there's always been some concerns about him defensively, but he certainly has the athleticism and the body to be able to play that third spot with those two guys. So it'll be interesting to see if he can kind of step up to this challenge under, you know, he's playing in a little bit different circumstance. I guess last year there was quite a bit of scrutiny, especially at the beginning of the season. But clearly he was, if you look at, you know, people were more interested in looking at, I think, Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball and getting an idea of what those two guys were. I think there was more of a consensus on what Kuzma was or is, whereas Lonzo and Brandon Ingram were more of unknowns. And now this year, clearly, if LeBron and Davis stay healthy, you know, this team's going to be at the top of the Western Conference standings for most of the year. And so there's going to be a big spotlight on the team, even bigger than there normally is. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if Kuzma can really step up into that third spot and be the kind of player that they need him to be. I think he can. It'll just be a matter of, you know, he's got to get it done. He's got to really produce out there on the floor. So heading into the season, Alex, what's your, other than maybe the, I guess the obvious one of, hey, how's Anthony Davis going to fit in? What's your most intriguing storyline that you're looking at going into this season?
So the funny thing is, for me, the storyline is not what the roster looks like on opening night, but what does it look like coming to the end of the season, going into the playoffs. All the playoff contenders for the last 4 or 5 years, when the buyout season hits, they pounce on the best veterans that are available. I want to see what Rob Pelinka, I want to see what Frank Vogel, I want to see what they do when the buyout market comes around, because the way the team looks today is fine. I think this is a really good team. But obviously the big guy that both LA teams are waiting on is Andre Iguodala. And Memphis is playing hardball. They want to try to get a draft pick for him, which I think is ridiculous. I think a guy like him, when you have a veteran that you know, is at the end of his career, I think he has a right to go out on his own terms. And I think what Memphis is doing is kind of lazy. I think it'll hurt them long term for veterans. But just in terms of today, if they were to buy him out, I want to see if this Lakers team can convince him to come join us. And I think, you know, this team has a good shot at it. But as I said, the storyline for me is, when there are trades available, when the buyout market hits, how does this new front office and this coaching staff, what do they do to make this team better? That to me is the storyline.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting to see. As you said, contenders, whether it's at the trade deadline or whether it's through the buyout market. I think Iguodala it's pretty much been out there that one of the two LA teams is where he'd like to end up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending upon where that ends up falling out. Could, who knows? That could swing the balance of power between the Clippers and the Lakers. You never know. Is there any chance that this team trades Kuzma if the right, if the right opportunity, the right offer comes, if the right guy becomes available? Is there any chance that could happen?
I mean, look, man, like anything, everyone has a price.
Right.
So if the right deal came along, then I would imagine they make a move. But the interesting thing about Kuzma is that, I think he was drafted like 27th overall a couple years ago. And to get the kind of production that he gives you from the 27th overall pick.
Right. Salary level. Exactly.
Every team would love to have a guy that can give you 19 points and you only pay like $2 million a year.
Right.
So it's kind of like if the right deal comes along, sure. But I think if the Lakers were going to trade him, it probably would have been in that Anthony Davis deal. They kept him for a reason. Obviously, cost control. But, the cost versus his production, I don't think he goes anywhere unless something big, presents itself.
All right. So let's go to the coaching staff. What's the feeling there on the Frank Vogel, Jason Kidd dynamic and how that's going to work out with LeBron, who's been notoriously difficult, let's just say, on coaches? What's the scuttle there right now as far as how the coaching staff is handling the whole team?
I mean, look, man, show me a superstar that's not hard on coaches.
Right. Right.
Like, LeBron gets a lot of blame for those things. Look, Kobe was hard on Phil Jackson, and he's the greatest coach of all time, in my opinion. Right. Like, Magic got Paul Westphal fired. Like, this is what, if you're one of the top, five guys in the NBA, you're pretty hard on coaches. In terms of Jason Kidd, from what I've seen and from what I've heard, Jason has admitted that he skipped steps going from playing to being a head coach. While most guys, they start off as assistants or guys in, the video production or guys on scouting, whatever it is. They rarely, if ever, go from, superstar player to first year head coach. So he admits that he skipped some steps. And I wasn't thrilled when the Lakers brought him in, but by all accounts, he's been okay. And I think it's more of a bigger deal for the national media. One, because he's got a famous name. He's Jason Kidd. He has an interesting past, to say the least. He and LeBron seem to have some kind of friendship or respect level, whatever it is. Maybe it's dating back to their time on Team USA. So there's this kind of idea amongst non-Laker fans that Jason Kidd is going to be a problem in trying to take over for Frank Vogel. Vogel has already come out and said he likes to have a guy that used to play in the NBA on his coaching staff because he never played in the NBA. So for right now, I'm going to take it for what it is, and things seem to be okay. If it takes a turn, so be it. But I'm a big believer in no matter what happens, if the Lakers are winning, I don't care what Jason Kidd does.
Right.
Like, winning fixes everything. Now, if the Lakers are losing, then that could become an issue. But, I mean, that just comes with, it's high stakes. Like, that just is just what it is.
Absolutely. And I think Frank Vogel has proved that he's a good coach. And so I think that is going to speak volumes. Hopefully it'll all work out. There won't be any underlying tension between those two. Certainly that was, as you said, in the national media, that seems to be the worry, the thought, that, why hire Vogel when Jason Kidd is there waiting in the wings and he has this relationship with LeBron. And so you hear all kinds of things. So it's good to hear from a Lakers standpoint that at this point, that doesn't appear to be an issue. I think that you made the best case scenario there, which is winning cures all.
Yep.
And so as long as you're winning, nothing else, the coaching becomes, I don't want to say irrelevant, but it becomes a lot less of a storyline if this team gets off to a good start and starts winning. So with that being said, best case, worst case scenario, let's start with the worst case. What could go wrong and what do you think the worst case scenario is for this team this year?
Worst case scenarios are injuries, man. I mean, the last 6 years we've missed the playoffs, right? But, the last 6 years we've been notoriously injured. And it started with when we traded for Steve Nash and he got hurt second game of the season, banging his knee, I think against Dame Lillard. And we haven't been right ever since. From Steve Nash not being right to Dwight Howard to Kobe tearing his Achilles on up. It's been terrible. And even with these young guys, Lonzo, Brandon Ingram, they can never be healthy. LeBron last year, he had his first major injury. if the Lakers can remain relatively healthy, and I don't mean like superhuman healthy, but just league average healthy, they'll be okay. That's right. Just my opinion.
Understood. All right, best case scenario. What can this team, where do you see them finishing? What do you think they can do, best case scenario? Title, NBA title?
Yeah, best case scenario is a title. Look, we are the only team in NBA with two top five players. The Clippers are the only other team that's close, but Paul George isn't a top five player. So you have two top five players. You look throughout history, particularly the Lakers' history, as I mentioned, some of the other duos, Shaq and Kobe, Magic and Kareem, Wilt and Jerry. You just look around the league. If you have two top five guys, you're in good shape. So I best case scenario is an NBA title.
Yeah, I think that the difference in this season compared to the seasons past is there's no Golden State lurking at the end of, you know, at the end of the rainbow for all these teams that have two superstars that are great. And I think you've made an excellent point here in saying that historically, if you have two of the top five or two of the top 10 players in the league, there's a good chance that you're going to be right there at the end. And I think if LeBron can continue to produce the way that he has and that Father Time doesn't start to catch up with him, which, you know, with the way he trains his body and all the things that he does to prepare. And again, really, this is the first time he's had somewhat of a long off season to rest and recover. And I know from him being here in Cleveland that I'm sure he took advantage of that time to rejuvenate his body. And I'm anticipating he's going to have an outstanding year. That you put those two guys together, and I think they're going to be right there, you know, battling for the top of the Western Conference. I think with the Clippers probably, and you know that to me right now is still a toss up with those two teams. I think that the Clippers have a chance to be maybe a little bit better defensively, whereas I think the Lakers might be a little bit better offensively. So if that would end up being the Western Conference final, I think it'd be a lot of fun to see, and I'm sure in LA it would be a lot of fun.
It would be, and I've talked to guys who cover the Utah Jazz and the Denver Nuggets, two teams that I think will be very good this season. And from beat writers to podcasters to whoever it is, I've asked them, you know, what do you think happens if Utah or the Nuggets face the Lakers in the playoffs? And everybody I've talked to that represent those teams has said, we don't think we're ready to beat you guys. That everyone basically says if we meet in the playoffs, you've got LeBron James, you've got Anthony Davis. Like that, we're not going to bet against you until we see our guys beat you. And you're right. The Clippers are a very, very good team. I like everything that they did. They did what they needed to do to take the next step. And I think it could very well come down to a LA Western Conference Finals. We don't know how long Paul George will be out. Some are saying he'll miss the first 10 to 20 games of the season. That can be significant because in the West, you know, if Paul George misses 10 games, you know, that could be the difference between you getting the second or third seed and the fifth or sixth seed. We really don't know.
That's for sure.
But I also tell people they will have a great defense and they should be very good offensively. But who on the Clippers is going to guard Anthony Davis? You know, you can throw Kawhi and Paul George at LeBron, but I don't – Zubac – I mean, I know Zubac firsthand. He was right. A Laker. Yeah. You know, yeah, Montrez, you know, he's like what?
Undersized for sure. Yep.
Yeah, so that's going to be – you know, so it'll be interesting to see how all these teams kind of fill out those holes in their roster as the season goes along.
Yeah, it's nice when every team at least has some kind of question mark. Whereas in the past, you know, especially, you know, we're sitting here in Cleveland where every year, you know, okay, man, maybe we can get through this weak Eastern Conference, but
right.
You're just waiting there for, you know, Golden State with, you know, four All-Stars and the shooting and just everything that they've had. And it was, you know, so disconcerting to know that that was what was waiting for you. And now this year, all these teams have some small flaw that depending on the matchups, I think there's a team out there that can match up or beat any other team, just again, depending on how it all, you know, comes together. And obviously injuries have a factor and, you know, there'll be things that, you know, these teams are all new. So we don't know for sure what it's going to look like, but just looking at it now, it seems like anybody, you know, on any given day, depending on those matchups, you could probably make a case for several different teams. So in your mind, give us your personal prediction of what you think the regular season record for the Lakers this year, and then what you think is going to happen in the playoffs and where they can go.
It's a 50-win season for me. Now, how many games over 50? I don't know. I place them somewhere between 50 and 55 wins.
Okay.
Beyond that, I think it's a championship team. There are things they got to work out, but to your point, there's no Golden State juggernaut waiting at the end of the tunnel. This season's different. This season is more like it's been for the better part of the, you know, NBA's history. So I think a championship is within their grasp. If they stay healthy, if they add the complementary pieces as they become available throughout the season, I'll be okay. And I've also told a lot of people on my show, even if the Lakers don't win a championship this year, that doesn't mean that it's a complete failure. For me, success this season is this team making the playoffs and the front office showing the rest of the NBA, specifically the rest of the free agents, Giannis will be one 2 years from now, showing everybody that we are past, you know, Jim Buss, right. Magic Johnson,
the turmoil is over.
All that is finished, that even if we don't win this year, we have finally got back to what Dr. Jerry Buss built this team into, and that's a competent roster, a competent franchise. That's a win to me. So that's kind of how I see it.
Well, it's going to be a fun season there in Lakerland for sure. I think that we had the opportunity here in Cleveland to watch LeBron for years and years and years, and he's just a great player. He makes people better. I think he's going to make Anthony Davis better, and there's no doubt that if it comes down to putting your money on LeBron against some of these other teams, you know, he's proven in the past that when he's on equal footing and he's not going against one-on-four like he was against Golden State oftentimes, that he's up to the challenge. So that's going to be, for me, that's going to be what's going to be interesting to watch, and I can't wait to see how this season plays out. To me, it's the most interesting season, despite the fact that our Cavs are going to be down at the bottom of the standings again. It's the most interesting NBA season in a while, just from getting to see all these new teams and new players and new faces. So I'm really looking forward to it. Alex, we can't thank you enough for being a part of the NBA preview pod here with us on the Hoopheads podcast. Hopefully at some point, maybe during the season when the Cavs and Lakers match up, maybe we can jump on again and get a little Lakers update, or maybe just talk some general NBA at that point.
Definitely, man. I'm happy to look forward to it, man.
Awesome. Cool. Alex, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for jumping on.
No problem, man. Thank you.
Yep. All right. You got it.
The Phoenix Suns with Mitch Krumpotich from the Sunny in Phoenix podcast.
All right. We're welcoming to the podcast tonight from the Sunny in Phoenix podcast, Mitch Krumpotich. Mitch, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely excited to talk to you a little bit about what's going on out there in the desert with the Phoenix Suns. Give us a quick recap of last year's season, kind of what you thought were some of the bright spots, some of the things that we still got to work on going into this season.
Well, you know, last season was pretty rough. It really was one of our worst. We won 19 games. So we haven't won more than 25 in over 5 years. So that's pretty rough. But last year was especially rough. We had Igor Kokoshkov come in as our head coach. He had worked with the Suns previously. He was in Utah. He came in as the head coach and had a system he really wanted to implement, and it didn't go well. You know, he was really stuck on that system, didn't really want to work with what guys brought, and we didn't have a point guard, so that didn't help anything. We had some bright spots in DeAndre Ayton, his rookie season, averaging 16 and 10. Pretty awesome for a rookie. Devin Booker also, he had his best scoring season from the three-point range. It wasn't quite as good, but he was taking a lot of shots. He had a huge load that he had to carry. He ran a lot of what we like to call on our podcast point Booker. Since we didn't really have a point guard, Devin Booker had to fill that role quite a bit. And he actually did pretty well, but it is not his natural spot at all. We also had Mikal Bridges, who was a bright spot, not a huge numbers guy, but a great defender. He came in as a rookie in kind of a complicated way through the draft and trades. And you probably remember the story of how he went to Philadelphia, where he has all those roots, and then got traded to the Suns. But we loved having him. Overall, though, pretty disappointing year. A lot of struggles at point guard, a lot of injury struggles, but we're looking forward to an improvement this season.
All right, so let's jump right into the point guard spot. You bring in Ricky Rubio. What's the feeling on how Rubio and Booker are going to fit together? What's the early returns on that looking like?
We're very excited. I've loved Rubio for a long time, just as a fan of the game. I think Ricky Rubio is a great player, very smart, awesome facilitator. I went to an open practice for the Suns actually recently. Just watching them run like three-man weave drills, five-man weave drills, run through some plays. And Ricky Rubio does a really good job of putting the ball exactly where it needs to be. And there were a few guys on the team who really were not ready to catch the ball because it was so perfect. And we're not used to having good passes thrown, really. It's a very good problem to have of guys getting used to getting the ball right where they need it so that they can go into that triple threat, be ready to shoot, to do whatever they need. But he's a quick decision maker, and we are so happy to have Ricky Rubio.
Are either Cam Johnson or Ty Jerome going to get a chance to get minutes in the rotation early in the season, do you think?
You know, this is a good question. For a long time, I was saying I don't think Cam Johnson is going to play very much this season. You know, he'll be like an actual rookie instead of like a Marquise Chris type who is super raw and still has to start. I was thinking maybe Cam Johnson, sit on the bench a little bit, get acclimated to the league, the speed, play 5 minutes here and there. But the more I see of him, the more I like him. He is a great shooter. He's got a really good feel for the game. And Mikal Bridges and Kelly Oubre were out during training camp with some minor injuries. I guess Cam Johnson went in and just played really well running with the first unit. So I'm thinking he might play a bit more than people expect. Ty Jerome, kind of the same thing. People have been saying he's looking really good in training camp. You know, older guys went through 4 years of college, so it makes a big difference. He really knows how to win, and that's something that's really nice to have, just one of those almost intangible things. I'm not quite sure how much he will play. I think it just depends on what it looks like once he actually gets on the floor.
All right, how are people feeling about DeAndre Ayton in terms of the guys that they passed over to take Ayton? Is there any regret of not taking Luka, or even now as Bagley's starting to get some buzz that he's really coming along there in Sacramento? How's the Phoenix fan base feeling about DeAndre Ayton and sort of his future going forward with the Suns?
Yeah, I think we feel good about Ayton. We're definitely not worried about Bagley. I don't think we're upset that we passed on him. Luka, it's tough. Luka's a great player. And no disrespect to Bagley. He's a great player, too. And I think he would have had an awesome season if he wasn't injured. I still really like him. But we're very happy with DeAndre. And I think a lot of people are looking for him to take a step forward on defense. He did look a little bit lost throughout the season last year, but toward the end, he really picked it up. And I think having Aaron Baines on the team is going to be a big help. I know that Monty Williams was saying that Aaron Baines and DeAndre Ayton have really been working together well, you know, pushing each other, especially Baines pushing Ayton. So getting that offensive experience of going up against someone like Baines who's going to push him around and then having to defend another big guy is nice. But just seeing some of that footwork come along, see him rotate a little bit better, and just he's got a year under his belt. He should be a bit more familiar with what to expect this season. So we're really excited. I know I'm really hoping he can average 11 rebounds or so and get his points average to a little bit closer to 20. I'm looking for him to take a step this year.
What's his ultimate ceiling? You think he's perennial all-star? Do you think he can be a guy that can get to a, you know, a top five, top 10 player in the league eventually? What do you see his ceiling being?
Oh, I mean, I don't want to put too high of expectations on a guy. Top five, top 10 player would be awesome. Of course, I think he, you know, perennial all-star. I think that's definitely a ceiling for him. I think he could really do that. It's so interesting to see the modern NBA center and how a lot of times we're seeing these stretch fives nowadays, and Ayton still isn't really shooting threes. He didn't take many last year. If he took any, it was like end of the shot clock, had to put something up. But I don't really expect him to shoot a lot of threes this year either. So it's interesting. You know, you look at guys like Embiid or Rudy Gobert, Ayton doesn't quite have the defense to be like those guys, but he has a really good offensive game. And if he can stretch that out past the three-point line, I think we can really be looking at some all-star consideration.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct on that. If he can add that range to what he has in terms of athleticism and how he finishes so well around the basket, I think he's definitely – the potential is there for him to be an all-star year in and year out, especially at the center position where – you know, I don't want to say it's completely diluted, but there just isn't as many centers, especially not in the mold of he's kind of an old school type guy. So if he can not only have the low post game, but also add some outside dimension to his, you know, to his skill set, I think he's going to really have an opportunity to be, have a really good career. What's your number one storyline heading into the season that you're going to watch for as you check out this team all season?
That's a really good question. I think I'm going to really be looking for playmaking because, like I said earlier, without having a point guard, a true point guard the last couple seasons, that's been rough. We've got Rubio now, but we also have the addition of Dario Saric, who is really known for being a good shooter and a stretch four, but can really make some plays. I know Monty Williams said that when he was in Philadelphia, he really wished he could have gotten Saric some more touches just so he could do a little bit more with the ball. So I'm excited to have him at the four. I think it's really nice that for the first time in 2 or 3 years now, we have guys with actual NBA experience at all five of our starting spots. We haven't been able to say that for a while. So playmaking, experience, those are the things that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, if you look up and down the entire roster, it's interesting. There's a lot of pieces here of guys that have had either success elsewhere or have had at least the potential of them turning into something. And it's just, it's a very interesting roster when you go up and down players 1 through, let's say, 10. You know, you've got guys that are kind of still upcoming, like Kelly Oubre. Nobody's sure quite what he's going to be or what he can be. You know, you got Frank Kaminsky, who came over from Charlotte, who, you know, people kind of know what he is, but, you know, who knows? Maybe you can find him the right role and he can maybe add a little bit more than what he was able to show in Charlotte. It's just a very, very interesting roster. So what do you think is, let's go best case, worst case scenario for the Phoenix Suns? Let's start with the best case and then give us the worst case if things don't turn out the way you expect.
Well, I'll start with the worst case.
All right.
I'm an optimist, so I want to get out of the way. Worst case is we look just like we did last year. You know, injuries, losing, you know, 60 games again. I think that's the worst case. Best case, I would say maybe winning 35 games is probably the best case scenario.
What do you think is the key for this team moving forward? Obviously, you want to continue to add talent and add better players around the guys that you have. They're going to be your core. But as you look into the future, 2-3 years down the road, what do you think in terms of the development of the guys that you have on the roster? Obviously, Booker and Ayton being the two key guys. What do you think needs to happen either with them or around them to get this team to the point where it can contend for a playoff spot?
The key is consistency. We have been changing coaches just about every year. You know, we have Monty Williams now. We're really happy about that. But we've had Igor Kokoshkov. We've had Earl Watson. We've had Jeff Hornacek. We've had Jay Triano. It's been a rough coaching carousel. And then personnel on the court has changed a lot too. We have quite a few new guys this year. I have a ball that's signed by the whole team from the 2017-18 season. And the only guy whose signature is on that ball that's still on the team is Devin Booker.
Oh, God. That's amazing. That's amazing.
It's actually a little bit depressing. So we need some consistency.
Do you think that how do people there in Phoenix feel about the Robert Sarver ownership situation?
we're not super fond of him.
Understood. enough said.
Well, we had a campaign last year where people were, I mean, this wasn't just like a Reddit thing. This actually happened. People made billboards that said like hashtag Sarver out, and it was all about trying to get rid of him. And obviously a billboard isn't going to stop a multimillionaire from like running his basketball team. But yeah, people aren't fond of him.
Understood. All right. So in your opinion, where do you see the Suns finishing up come mid-April of next year? Regular season ends. Where do you see their record playing out? You laid out the best case, the worst case scenario. What's your case for where the Suns are going to finish?
Yeah, I've been predicting 30 games, 30 wins for the last couple of weeks. I think that's doable. I mean, I'm not going to say we're going to make the playoffs or anything. I mean, the West is brutal. It has been for a while, but it just got better this year. So I want to say 30 wins. I don't think we're as bad as we were last year, but I think 30 wins is what I'm really looking for.
Do you think that, does that get them out of the basement of the West? Does that put them, can they finish ahead of any other team in the West? Because I know that most, you look at most prognostications say that Phoenix is going to clearly be the worst team. So is there any possibility? Who do you think they could maybe sneak up ahead of in the Western Conference standings? Is there anybody?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think here.
Because I think if they win 30, I got to think that unless there's just a ton of teams in the East that are way down low, that 30's got to get them out of, you know, out of the basement. And there's going to be one or two teams that people think are going to be better this year that are either going to have injury problems or, you know, something's going to go wrong. And there's going to be some teams in the West that win, you know, between 23 and 30 games, I would think.
Yeah, you know, it's really tough. I mean, when you look at it up and down, it's like Sacramento, they're probably going to be better. I like what they're doing with De'Aaron Fox. Memphis, I think Memphis is probably the team that will finish ahead of. They're a little bit of a mess.
They're young. They're definitely going to be young.
Yeah, but, you know, other than that, it's...
Yeah, it's a murderer's row out there. That's for sure.
If you put
Phoenix in the East, then, you know, then they could, I don't know that they contend for a playoff spot, but they're certainly, their win total is certainly higher without question if they could fatten themselves up on the East rather than the West.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, Mitch, we appreciate you jumping on tonight with us to talk Phoenix Suns basketball. It's nice getting an insider perspective from you, and we will catch everyone on the next preview. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
The Sacramento Kings with Damian Barling from the Sacramento Kings podcast.
We're pleased to welcome to the podcast to talk Sacramento Kings, Damian Barling from the Sacramento Kings podcast. Damian, welcome.
I appreciate you guys having me, man. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on and talk some Kings basketball. Let's go back to last season. Can you kind of give us a quick recap of how things ended up and kind of what the state of the Kings were at the end of last year's regular season?
Well, sure. At the end of last year's regular season, Dave Yeager was still the coach. Last year was kind of a tale of two seasons. There was really the first quarter, maybe a little over a quarter of the season, 30 games or so, 33 games, where the Sacramento Kings are playing really fast. And you started hearing Dwayne Wade and Eric Spoelstra and Greg Popovich and a variety of players, Hall of Fame players, Hall of Fame coaches around the league talking about the Sacramento Kings and the pace of play. They said they knew the Sacramento Kings were fast. They knew that the pace was fast, but it wasn't until they got out on the floor that they realized how fast they were. Unfortunately, they weren't able to keep that pace through the entire year. And a really promising season, certainly anything better than they've done in, you know, the previous decade or so, it kind of dwindled down, and I would say by the last 10 games of the season, most of us who were covering the Sacramento Kings got a pretty comfortable feeling that Dave Yeager wasn't going to be back at the head coaching position. We had heard a lot of rumors surrounding Luke Walton. We knew of the situation going on in Los Angeles. So without anybody, you know, making it official, we were pretty confident that Dave Yeager was going to be out and Luke Walton was going to be in. And that's kind of where we were by the time Game 82 ended.
So Luke Walton, obviously one of the key additions to the team and what he brings, and then bringing in Trevor Ariza as a free agent and re-signing Harrison Barnes. What was the feeling there in Sacramento about re-signing Barnes and at the price point where you re-signed him?
Well, you get all sorts of reactions to those types of contracts. Harrison Barnes got a very healthy deal. Sacramento Kings probably paid more for Harrison Barnes than any other team in the league would, but that's kind of where the Kings are at right now in the pantheon of NBA teams. You have to overpay guys to, in this case, make them stick around. And we all believed when the trade was done with Harrison Barnes last year that it was done with the purpose of, barring him falling flat on his face and this being an epic disaster, that he was going to be back with the Kings, or at least that the Kings were going to make a strong effort to make sure that he was back. So, you know, you always get the, oh, that's way too much money. That's a joke. And, oh, yep, that's exactly what we have to do. You know, that's exactly the way the Kings have to play. And the fact is, Kings had the money. You know, they had the money to be able to get the guys to be able to overpay Harrison Barnes. They weren't in the sweepstakes for, you know, guys like LeBron James and those other top-tier free agents. So it worked, and they still had money to spend. You mentioned Trevor Ariza, which was a signing I didn't see coming. Like, that one caught me off guard. The Dwayne Dedman was one we were prepared for. We were confident Willie Cauley-Stein wasn't going to be back. And it looked like they had made a commitment to defense. Now, you know, not to, you know, get too far down this rabbit hole, but, you know, Luke Walton had his introductory press conference, and then, you know, it was just a couple of days later that he had some accusations levied against him. And, you know, rightfully so, the Kings kind of put him away after that while this NBA investigation was going on and all of those different things. So during free agency, when guys like Trevor Ariza and Corey Joseph and Rashawn Holmes and Dwayne Dedman were being signed, we weren't hearing from the head coach. So on the outside, it looked like there was, at least in terms of personnel-wise, is they were trying to make some sort of commitment to the defensive side of the ball. You know, Trevor Ariza's, you know, best defensive days were, you know, a decade ago. He's still a fine defender. Dwayne Dedman and Rashawn Holmes, Corey Joseph, those guys are upgrades on the defensive side of the ball. Dwayne Dedman, a huge defensive upgrade over Willie Cauley-Stein. So it felt like as those guys were coming in, particularly the Trevor Ariza one, it was like, okay, it appears that they have an approach that they're going to take with this free agency. It appears that they have defensive guys that they really like. They want to make a commitment to defense while maintaining, you know, their core and keeping their fast play. Their core players, of course, being, you know, De'Aaron Fox, who I think everything in the offense and everything in the franchise is built around, and then Buddy Hield and Marvin Bagley.
Do you think that the Trevor Ariza signing had anything to do with the fact that he played with Walton in 07 and 09? Is that what happened, that they were able to get him to come there, do you think?
Sure. I mean, relationships are a part of every walk of life. You know, when Vince Carter signed here and Zach Randolph signed here and those guys came, that had a lot to do with Scott Perry. It had a lot to do with the relationships that those guys had with him during the, you know, month and a half that he was the assistant general manager for the Sacramento Kings before he went off to New York. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure that played a factor in it. Trevor Ariza has gotten some pretty nice contracts over the last few years, you know, really based off of, and this, I'm not trying to knock Trevor Ariza, but his two biggest moments were, you know, they were a decade ago in the Western Conference Finals as a Los Angeles Laker during that time frame that you just brought up. Like, I can't think of any other standout Trevor Ariza plays besides those two that he had against the Denver Nuggets. Again, that's not a knock. It was just a decade ago. So yeah, like I'm sure relationships played a factor in it. Yeah.
All right. So obviously the key to the overall long-term development and success of the franchise is how De'Aaron Fox, Bagley, and Buddy Hield continue to develop. And Fox, there seems to be a pretty strong consensus that he's going to end up being one of the best guards in the league at some point here in his career. Bagley, I think the jury was out early, and he really came on before he got injured. So going into this season, what's the feeling like as far as what production levels they expect from Fox and Bagley? What do they expect to get out of those guys in their respectively their second and third years?
Bagley's 20-12, for sure. He averaged that last year. Any time that he played over, I think it was 30 minutes. And Dave Yeager didn't play him over 30 minutes very often. He had, you know, he never started. He wasn't a consistent starter. There were games where guys were injured or whatever, and he would start. But he was never, you know, he was never written in as the starter. And that was just always, oh, that's Dave Yeager's philosophy. That's how it is. Was probably played a part in his demise as the Sacramento Kings coach. But I think, I do, and I actually, you know, wonder just based off the positions if Marvin Bagley might wind up an all-star before De'Aaron Fox does. Again, just based on the difficulty of the positions, I think right. De'Aaron Fox is a bona fide superstar. I think he's going to be a major, major, major player in the league, not just for the Sacramento Kings, but in the NBA. He's going to be a name that all NBA fans know and like to watch. But Marvin Bagley at that different position, I think he's a 20-12 guy. You know, we've always, you know, since DeMarcus Cousins has left, they've always looked for that guy to be, you know, who's who's the guy who can fill that, you know, the scoring gap and the rebounding gap that hasn't existed since DeMarcus Cousins was here. And that's Marvin Bagley. Like, Marvin Bagley is a stud. And those two, as you guys noted, those two guys are the keys to the franchise moving forward. I don't know what De'Aaron's development is going to look like. He made a big jump from year one to year two. I think if we see a big jump from De'Aaron again this year, it's probably going to be on the defensive end. I think he's going to start utilizing some of that speed, which is something Luke Walton has really preached over the first. I think they've had four practices over 3 days. Three of those practices I know started with defense. And as much as Luke Walton is talking about pace and talking about playing even faster than he did last year, he's talking about teaching defense. And that's something that the Sacramento Kings have bought into, particularly De'Aaron Fox and Marvin Bagley. And I think that might be something that De'Aaron Fox got from, you know, USA Basketball as well during his brief time there, is that commitment to the defensive side of the ball. So I think we're going to see a huge jump from Bagley just overall in his entire game, because he's going to be playing more consistent minutes in a very, very consistent role. And then I think we're going to see a big jump from De'Aaron Fox on the defensive end.
Any insider information on why Fox left Team USA right before the eve of the World Cup? Any thoughts on that?
I have, well, thoughts on it and insider information. He's not talking about it. Yeah, he's not talking about it. He was asked about it on Media Day. He just said, no, I'm not going to talk about that. My opinion is remember De'Aaron was, as was Marvin Bagley, those guys were a part of the select team.
Right.
So the idea was like, hey, come hang out in Los Angeles, come hang out in Las Vegas, get a little ball in. You're going to be around, you know, if you're De'Aaron Fox, you're going to be around Kemba Walker. You're going to be around, you know, some, you know, top tier players in the NBA. You get to get a good little run in. You get to be around Greg Popovich, learn from him and Steve Kerr and some of these assistant coaches. And then, hey, we'll send you off on your merry way. And then suddenly it was like, hey, De'Aaron could be the starting point guard for the World Cup team. And now all of a sudden it's not Las Vegas and Los Angeles. It's Las Vegas and Los Angeles. And then I think you're off to Australia for a while for like 10 days. And then you're off to China, and suddenly your 2 week, you know, California, Nevada trip to play basketball has turned into like a month and a half commitment. And, you know, my thing with the World Cup was always there's a lot of scrutiny in it and there's no glory. Like, there's a lot of talk about the World Cup team losing. Right.
There's
a ton of talk about. Well, we've already heard, I think Dame Lillard, hey, I'm coming to the rescue. Don't worry. I'm going to fix this. Steph Curry, hey, we're going to fix this. We're going to get in there. I'm committed. I'm committed to the Olympics. We're going to win this. If the team had won, no one would care.
Right.
Because it's not the Olympics. I mean, it's cool to have the world championships and it's whatever, but we know if LeBron wants to play, he's going to play. We know if James Harden wants to play, he's going to play. Same with Russell Westbrook and all those other guys. I did wonder if De'Aaron stayed and the team won, would De'Aaron Fox have an opportunity, like a real legitimate opportunity to be on the 2020 Olympic team? He still may very well have that chance. I don't think so, but he might. But that was a really long-winded way of answering your question.
You answered it very well. Jason and I talked a little bit on the show, on our show earlier about, Is there a linchpin guy for that 2020 Olympics? Where was it when we talked about, was it LeBron or was it Steph? Maybe that once one of those guys committed, would that then draw sort of everybody else to come in and play? And I guess it still remains to be seen who ends up, you know, committing and who ends up not committing. But the fact that Dame and Steph committed early, I think bodes well for maybe some of those other guys eventually getting involved. So we'll have to see. Who knows if all the leagues.
I think the answer to your question is LeBron, though. I think the league still goes as LeBron goes. So if LeBron commits to the Olympics, I think Anthony Davis is going to commit, and I think James Harden is going to commit, and I think Russell Westbrook is going to commit. It's great that Dame Lillard did. I'm really happy that he did. It's great that Steph Curry did as well. But LeBron James is the needle mover, and he's the one who brings guys along with him. So if LeBron commits, that's when you're going to see the influx of that NBA.
I have to say, we're at the start of media days and all these teams are talking like they're getting all those questions. The stars are getting all the questions and they're like, of course we'd love to play for Team USA, but no one's saying, oh yeah, I'm definitely playing. There's been a lot of different people that have come out and said, oh yeah, I'm interested in playing, blah, 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 blah. But no one's definitively said, yes, I'm playing no matter what. And I just find it interesting. I think you're right though. I think LeBron's definitely still the linchpin, which is kind of crazy to think about, but
Yeah, I mean, he's still the king. When number 23 gives the nod, man, you'll see people follow. He's, I mean, look what he did for, you know, if you don't think he was influential in what Gavin Newsom did the other day, like, you're crazy. Like, there aren't a lot of players who could have, you know, sat, you know, side by side with the governor of a state and got legislature that's going to change, you know, the entire complexion of the NCAA here in the upcoming years. Like, that's LeBron. And that's, he has that influence on the league. He has that influence on FIBA, and apparently he has that influence in the state capital as well. And I'm all for it.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think it's a great development, and you know, it's hopefully the first brick that drops here as we start moving the NCAA in a more positive direction for the student athletes that participate in it. What is, in your mind, heading into this season, what's the biggest storyline that you're going to watch for as we head into the beginning of the regular season?
Storyline for me, I'm just going to watch development. I want to see De'Aaron continue to develop, and I want to see Marvin Bagley continue to develop. I think the Kings have done a great job, and it started with Vlade a couple of weeks ago when he was getting inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame. He was on the jump with Rachel Nichols, and you know, the conversation, rightfully so, was about Vlade and his career. And when they shifted to the Sacramento Kings, Rachel asked him, like, hey, you know, do you think your Sacramento Kings, you know, what are your expectations? Do you think they're going to be a playoff team next year? And he's like, well, my expectations are for us to continue to get better. And I think when that question came up during Media Day over the last couple of days, when it came up over Media Day on Friday, everybody was really careful with how they answered that, because obviously De'Aaron Fox withdrawing from USA Basketball because he wants to make the playoffs, and Marvin Bagley focused on the upcoming season, and you've already got those nuggets out there. But when those guys are asked about it, they were, you know, they answered about the competitiveness of the West, and they talked about just improving as a basketball team, improving on the defensive side of the floor, and maintaining, you know, having a strong 82 game season rather than having a strong, you know, 33 game start to the season. So for me, I want to see, you know, the biggest storyline to me is Luke Walton. Like, it's great that De'Aaron is here and Marvin Bagley and Buddy Hield, and we saw what those guys were able to do last year. But there is a wild card in that there's not only a new coach, but there's an entirely new coaching staff. So how does that play out over the course of, you know, the first few weeks of the season? And are they able to keep the pace? Are they able to play defense? And are they able to improve? Like, there are a lot of really good teams in the Western Conference. Even the non-playoff teams, I think they're good. I don't think Oklahoma City is nearly as bad as people think that they are. No, I don't think they're a playoff team, but I don't think they're awful. I'm not big on Minnesota, but I think they'll fight and they'll be scrappy, and Phoenix is going to have to get better at some point, I would think. So, you know, even the teams, again, that aren't in the playoff, you know, position, that you don't think are going to be in the top eight, they're going to be better. So, you know, there's these no grand thoughts of making the playoffs or proclamations for winning 50 games. And I know that that's the thought of, you know, the fan base here. Because, and rightfully so, I mean, this fan base is starved just to see a playoff game at the new arena. But I just want to see them get better. I don't want to see them regress under Luke Walton. I don't want to see the tempo that they played at last year winding up being just a fad. I want to see them continue to develop. And I want to see De'Aaron and Marvin Bagley take their next steps to being All-Stars.
So from an individual standpoint, what are those next steps? Let's take each guy at a time. I think you mentioned a little bit with De'Aaron improving on the defensive end of the floor, and the same could obviously probably be said for Bagley. But is there one or two things from each one of those guys that you're looking for and say, hey, if they're really progressing the way that the team would like them to, this is a skill or this is something we'd like to see them add to their game this year? Is there something you could point to for each of those guys?
Well, De'Aaron, I want De'Aaron to be the lockdown defender. Because ultimately by the end of this year, I think De'Aaron Fox has a chance to be on one of the all NBA defensive teams. Marvin Bagley, it's going to be interesting. Luke Walton said the other day that they have had a conversation about how many threes they expect to shoot per game. And right now that number is, before the season starts, that number set at 35. And as much as Buddy Hield was salivating at that, thinking, man, he could probably shoot 30 of those 35 threes. I think the idea is they want to get Marvin Bagley involved from the outside. So that's not something we saw a ton of last year, but it's something that we know that he's capable of. So if we see, you know, if individually, so for me, if I see De'Aaron wind up being that lockdown defender where, you know, the game is on the line, we saw this happen to De'Aaron Fox at the hands of, oh man, was it Eric Gordon last year? I think De'Aaron had the ball in the final seconds, and Eric Gordon was just playing just violent defense on him because his team had a foul to give. And he was just playing aggressively, and the referees didn't blow the whistle. He was playing aggressive. And ultimately, he just swiped the ball away from him, and the Kings wound up losing by two. I want De'Aaron to be that guy. Like, I think De'Aaron can be that guy. He can be that defender that the Sacramento Kings rely on at the end of the game. And then if you got Marvin Bagley shooting 3 to 5 threes a game, he's going to hit a couple of those. And I told you, I already think he's a 20 and 12 guy. Those are the steps that I want to see those two guys take this year.
All right, mid-April, when the regular season ends, where do you see the Sacramento Kings finishing up next year?
I think there's a good chance that they're in ninth again. I think there's a good chance they're in ninth, but they might be in ninth with like 42, 43 wins. You know, you could play the game. Well, the Sacramento Kings are going to make the playoffs. Like, okay, great. Tell me who's not.
Yep.
Like, that's you know, how it always boils down when someone says, yo, this person was an all-star stuff. It's like, okay, if you want to put that person on the all-star team, who are you going to take off? Well, in this case, people got the Los Angeles – I assume people got the Los Angeles Lakers making the playoffs, right? Well, you got to remove somebody. Well, the easy one to remove, I guess, is Oklahoma City. Okay, well, who's the second team that you're going to remove? Don't tell me you're removing San Antonio, because there is absolutely no history that says you're right. They got DeJounte Murray coming back. So let's not pretend that they're still not, you know, a very good basketball team. I got the Clippers winning the conference, for goodness sake. One of the worst takes in all of sports is that the Golden State Warriors aren't going to make the playoffs. That's insane to me. So who are you taking out of that playoff position to where the Sacramento Kings can go in? I'm not sure who it is. Weird things happen. You know, I love basketball. I don't want anything to happen to Dame or CJ, but if something were to happen to one of them, that's going to put the, you know, Portland Trailblazers in a tough spot. The Denver Nuggets could lose somebody. The Utah Jazz could lose somebody. Maybe that's how the Sacramento Kings get in. But right now, you know, barring catastrophic injuries to marquee players, I can see the Sacramento Kings winning 40-plus games and just you know, sitting on the outside of the playoffs.
Can the Sacramento Kings move to the Eastern Conference? That's the question. That's how they get in the playoffs.
I'd guarantee a playoff spot if the Sacramento Kings.
or we go to the top 16, right? You go to seed the top 16 teams in the league.
You know what's funny? We do that every year, and it almost always winds up the top 16 teams make it. It doesn't feel like it, but as the season progresses, as you get into that final month, if you go look at it, I think it happened last year because the Kings had 39 wins, and I feel like the 8 seed, which maybe was Washington, but I can't remember. I feel like they were like 40 or 41. You know what I mean? Like, we always say that.
Detroit was the 8. I forget where they finished. Were they 500? They might have been a game.
I think they were 500. I think they were dead on 500.
Yeah, Washington didn't make the playoffs last year, did they? They were a disaster. There's no way they made the playoffs. There's no way they're making the playoffs this year.
We don't have to worry about Washington making the playoffs. I think we're pretty safe.
That's the one team that the Cavs are definitely better than. I'm feeling.
Dude, they're a candidate for worst team in the league this year, man. They're going to be rough to watch. Absolutely. Poor Bradley Beal.
Yeah, well, he may be. Who knows? They may be shipping him out at some point too. So we'll have to. We'll have to wait and see it, keep our eyes on it and see what happens. Well, I think you're right on there. I think it's, you know, you made a great point of who do you take out if you're putting the Kings in, and to your point of, you know, the individual development of the young guys on the team and then the overall development of the team as a whole underneath Luke Walton. I think that's going to be interesting to see. And they certainly have, there's a nice foundation here. And now it's going to be a matter of can they build on it and really put the right guys around their key, you know, their three key young guys, and Ken Fox and Bagley develop into perennial all-star guys, or are they going to end up being just a shade below that? And that'll probably ultimately determine what the ceiling of this team is in the next 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, there's a lot that they got to figure out along the way, too. You know, Bogdan Bogdanovic is really good. You think that Harry Giles still has, you know, a lot of potential, but are those guys going to wind up being, you know, I always create the who's the Jason Williams of this group? You know, Jason Williams was a beloved player here for that early version of the playoff, you know, the playoff Sacramento Kings, right. You know, when they started winning, but they had to ship him off to take that next step and get Mike Bibby in here? Is there someone on this roster that you're ultimately going to have to ship off in a year or two to be like, you know what, we really need someone in this spot, or we really need someone who can do this? They're going to have to learn all of that. They've got to learn that, you know, this year. They've got to learn that next year. There's a lot of things that they have to figure out collectively and individually over the course of the next year or two, and hopefully that will help them figure out what they're going to do with that core group.
Well, the nice part of it is that for the first time in a long time, there's actually some hope and some young players there that have some potential, and it seems like that there's a plan and things are at least heading in the right direction where the fans can finally be at least somewhat optimistic that things are turning the corner. And I'm sure as somebody who's followed the team and as a fan that you're, you know, at least you've got some good basketball to look forward to be able to watch over the next few years.
Yeah. If nothing else, it should be entertaining.
No question. Damian, we can't thank you enough for joining us tonight and talking Sacramento Kings basketball. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we can, at some point, maybe during the season, we can jump back on and talk some more Kings basketball with you.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Damian. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.